Welcome to an Arsenal podcast, The Clock and Talk. I'm your host, Tez. Join myself, Tony, Carl, Schmidt and Savvy as we talk Arsenal.
Hello. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. You're listening to A Clock and Talk, an Arsenal podcast. And we have returned on Christmas Eve, and maybe in some parts of the world, Christmas already. But wherever you're listening from, thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. A very Merry Christmas to you, all of you and your loved ones. Today, I'm joined by Tony. You all right, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Yeah, okay, surviving after that brutal game. We'll come to that. Carl makes an appearance. How are you doing, Carl?
Yeah, I'm good, man.
So let's get right into it, because I don't think we have the time to talk anything else today. Tony, right to you. Lineups. Talk me through what you felt when you saw Niles, Iwobi, and Mustafi missing out.
For anyone that follows us on Twitter, I tweeted before the game saying I thought the lineup was wrong. I can see the reasoning in playing Niles. He's probably quicker over the ground. He's certainly quicker over the ground than Kolasinac. Doesn't bump forward as much, so in theory leaves you less exposed. And also, by having an inverted fullback against Salah, who his intention is to cut in on his left foot, it makes sense to have him cutting in onto a defender's stronger foot. Would I have started him? Probably not, but I can see the sense in it. I think somewhere along the line we've got confused with Nacho. As much as I rate him, he's a very good third centre-back. And now when we've converted to about a two centre-back system, a back four, it seems like they forgot that he's not actually a centre-back. It's like Azpilicueta is a brilliant third centre-back at Chelsea, but they wouldn't dream of playing him in a two. And so I don't really know where that idea's come from. Beyond that, Hector was obvious. Granite and Jack in front of him was obvious. I said on the podcast he'd start Iwobi. It would never be my choice. Never, ever, ever. But I think we all knew that was what he was going to do. For anyone that follows us on Twitter, it was me that tweeted before the game that it may be a controversial opinion, and I know it's one that people won't agree with, but if we're playing three behind the striker, for me, Walcott is the only option to play on that right side. He's the only one that naturally is a right winger. As much as he tells you he wants to be a striker, he's played over 10 years as a right winger. And he is a genuine goal threat. I mean, look, I know his touch is awful and he can go missing and he can be very disappointing. But he is a threat, and no defence will leave space in behind with him on the pitch because they're so scared of the pace in behind. Welbeck is probably close to as quick, but he tends to come towards the ball, which we have a lot of players that do that. Well, all of our players come towards the ball, whereas Walcott runs away from it, meaning that you can't leave too much space in behind, which buys your midfield an extra 10 yards. Which then automatically makes them look like better players. I was disappointed with the lineup, but I wasn't surprised.
Carl, 20 minutes in, the tempo seemed set. Our passes could not find our teammates. I mean, we were so astray, so wayward. Liverpool didn't have to work hard to regain possession, and we just didn't click. There were so many crosses coming in from the left as well. I mean, Hector had no support with Iwobi, sort of just not in the game at all. I don't think Iwobi has had a worse game. And this brings me on to our first user question today, which is that if should Iwobi be playing in the first team? At TJB_1998 says that in his opinion, he shouldn't be. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree 100%. I don't think he's first team quality. A couple of seasons back, he had a good half of the season, but he's fallen down ever since. That game against Liverpool proved it. I mean, he was just dribbling. That was the only good part of his game, and even then, he was losing possession. His passes were wayward. His shots are probably the worst I've seen out of an attacking player. They're so tame, but. Yeah, if we're going back onto the idea about 20 minutes in, yeah, I don't know if it's a kind of a theme this season of us not being at the races in big games. I mean, obviously we had that Tottenham game and we had the Chelsea game and all that where we were good, but then sometimes we just switch off and it costs us. And against Liverpool, who were notoriously good for going straight out of the blocks and, you know, getting an early goal, it was always going to be a threat, and we should have known that instead of being, you know, being relaxed at the start. I'd say I think we were relaxed.
Talk me through to the first goal. I mean, we gave the ball away in their half. Two, three quick passes by Liverpool, and James Milner just lofts one over our back line, and Mohamed Salah chases down. Our defense was sort of had to improvise at that point because of our players being out of position, and Wilshere slipped. You know, it was sort of like a domino effect where things started from bad and only got worse in those few moments. Should Koscielny have done better there, or were we just unlucky or unaware, Tony?
For me, look, I think Koscielny had one of his worst games in years and has been, well, I say one of his worst games in years. He's been bad for about the last 5 weeks, and consistently bad. But in terms of the first goal, I think he was a bit unlucky because it was Salah. You've got to be over-hesitant of letting him cut in on his left foot. So he can't fully block that. He can't. If it had been a right-footed player, he would have fully blocked that attempted cross. But where you've got to have half a mind of, I can't let this guy onto his left foot, your position is a little bit different, which, I mean, it makes it very difficult. And he's also unlucky. He gets a foot to it and it loops up in the air straight to Coutinho. So I don't, as much, as bad as Koscielny was, I don't put him at fault for that goal. He was just unlucky. I thought Granit and Jack maybe could have done more to get to Coutinho. I don't actually personally think they would have got there. I think it would have looped for Coutinho anyhow. But, I mean, obviously, if they would have been there, it would have given more of a chance. And it probably just goes, we like to have someone to blame. But I think even if both of them had carried on their runs, I don't think either of them would have got to him, especially when I think it was Granit stopped at the edge of the box expecting the cutback, and Coutinho also slowed down his stride. So I think everyone was expecting the cutback, but Coutinho was quite clever and he stopped and then started again. And as a defender, where you're second guessing what someone's going to do, it's always going to be difficult. But I've seen a lot of people blame Xhaka, and I think it's just because it's Xhaka. I've not seen anyone blame Jack, and for me, they're equally at fault or equally not at fault.
Yeah, I agree. It was a very tough pill to swallow. I mean, for the first, 26 minutes, as I said, Liverpool were dominant. They were already creating chances. I think Firmino had a header that was threatening, and they had a couple of attempts from in and around the edge of the box. But Carl, we have another question, and I think this is a good time to talk about that, and that's from Glenn. Mm-hmm. Now, he goes on to ask, in your opinion, was Maitland-Niles' selection justified? I definitely think he was my man of the match. He held Salah and Mane pretty well. So he's trying to get a sense of how we feel about Maitland-Niles, because throughout the Twitter community as well, there seems to be quite a lot of polarization about this. So I'll get your thoughts on this and then pose the same question to Tony.
Yeah, well, I think we had a little discussion about this after the game, and at first I was like, oh, he was kind of the wrong choice because he had that lack of experience. He lost the ball a fair few times. He got caught in possession high up, but, you know, looking more in hindsight and looking more into, you know, how he was in that game, I thought he actually had a good performance. I think the selection was justified. Obviously, if you go by the aspect of stamina and the fact that Kolasinac played on Tuesday to get his fitness back, I'd say, yeah, it was a justified selection. I thought Maitland-Niles did hold his own, and he has arguably got a bit more pace than Kolasinac, and he definitely did well to mark Salah and Firmino. I think without him, there definitely would have been a lot more attacking threat from Liverpool. So, I think he was the right selection on the day.
Tony?
No, it's difficult. I thought he had a very good game. I think there's an argument for him for giving him man of the match. A lot of that, he made mistakes, but he recovered himself. So it's like, do you reward that or do you think that that's rubbish because he's made the mistakes in the first place? I mean, it's difficult because we never will know how Kolasinac would have done. So justifying the selection is difficult to say. Did he have a good game? Yes. Did he justify the selection? I mean, yeah, I think you've got to say yes, but there are always going to be people that say, well, Kolasinac would have been better, and that's that no one will ever know. So it's difficult to say in that sense, but as I said, in terms of did he play well enough to justify a selection, then you've got to say yes.
I'll be honest with you guys. I like the kid. I think he did a good job, as Tony said. What bothers me is the pattern that has sort of emerged in the last few years. Particularly what comes to mind is Alex Iwobi himself, who has sort of maybe played a decent amount with Maitland-Niles in coming up the ranks. We saw Iwobi hit the scene pretty well, I think it was last season. And, you know, it feels like with Wenger, there's always that one big game where a youngster will come in and do a job and do a decent job. I think for Iwobi, it was perhaps the Barcelona game that we played away at the Nou Camp. And I feel the youngster just gets run into the ground. Of course, the inexperience comes into it a bit, you know, not having the sense of managing your energy and knowing exactly how to operate and when. Is that something that bothers you, Tony? I mean, I know you're an advocate for bringing in players into the first team wherever. First, they break into the team and then sort of find their groove. But this pattern, and maybe it's just Iwobi and Maitland-Niles, but do you think that's something to worry about in the long run?
I mean, I don't think there is a pattern. Look, obviously, you bring up the Iwobi point, but I wouldn't say Maitland-Niles has been run into the ground. He's played about six games, and he's played three league games in a row, but there's been Europa League and Cup games in between them when he hasn't played. So it's not like he's playing every 3 days. He missed out on the West Ham game, and then so he played against Newcastle at home on Saturday, missed out on Tuesday, and played again on Friday. I mean, any footballer, if you can't play essentially once a week, then give up. I'd be quite surprised. I know we're probably going to come onto it later, but I'd be quite surprised to see him play against Palace. I wouldn't be disappointed, but I'd be quite surprised for the reasons you've said. Again, we've also got to remember that this year we don't have first team games every 3 days due to the lack of proper European football or Champions League football. I don't think there is the opportunity really to get run into the ground except in December, but then every team's going to have players that run into the ground. Like, I just use Chelsea as an example. Christiansen, who's young and just coming into their team, is probably going to play every game over this Christmas period, and no one will say, "Oh, he's being run into the ground." It is over Christmas. There's games every 2-3 days, and someone's got to play in them. So I don't really think there is a pattern of overplaying Maitland-Niles. As I said, I think I maybe agree with you with Iwobi, but I'd probably even say then I don't. I mean, thinking back, it was 2 seasons ago. It wasn't last season. And especially that Barcelona game you're talking about. But it wasn't like he was starting week in, week out. He came in towards the back end of the year, played against Barcelona. I remember he scored against Everton. I was at West Ham when he played very well away. But it wasn't like he was starting every week and got completely burnt out. And also, he only came in at the second half of the season. So, again, as a professional footballer, if you can't play half a season, you've got to take a long, hard look at yourself. You can't blame anyone else for that.
Mm-hmm. Some thoughts there acquired for sure. Carl, talking through the first half, I mean, we were dazed and confused, very lackadaisical in possession, wasteful. Was this the worst first half in recent memory?
No, I'd probably say the first Liverpool fixture this year. I think that was kind of typical of Arsenal this season, this first half. I think so. Sometimes we try and slow down the pace against a big team to try and get it to our sort of pace rather than theirs. If we're talking about a fast-paced team like Liverpool, and I think that was just a kind of the epitome of our performance against those types of teams in the first half this season. So I don't think it was the worst, but regardless, it was a horrendous first half. I mean, the passes were going everywhere but the intended targets, and Iwobi, I know we kind of use him as a scapegoat, but there's so many other players that were playing bad. I think Lacazette had a good first half. He was always making the runs. He was making the runs throughout the game, so can't say anything bad about him. But definitely Iwobi. I didn't see anything significant from Bellerin, but to be fair, I haven't seen it all season. I just didn't think it was a good first half. But they must have got a good talking to in halftime, because we did come out firing second.
Oh yeah, I remember sometime in the second half when after we had scored the third goal already, I remember writing down in my notes in brackets what was said in that dressing room, you know, because we always hear that Arsene Wenger is one of the more passive managers, if you will, when it comes to team talk. So I'm definitely curious about that. And then we'll come to Hector Bellerin's comments about that in the post-match interview as well. Tony, halftime comes around and we see Nacho being taken off for Mustafi. Now, there was a challenge in the first half that sort of left Nacho on the ground. And I think it was also confirmed, if I'm not wrong, after the game that it was an ankle injury that forced the move. But Mustafi comes in, coming back from injury. This was his first appearance in a few weeks. And within 5 minutes, we concede a horrible goal. I remember Arsenal fans making a lot of fun of Chelsea when they went to Roma, and there was an instance where three defenders got sucked in. And we managed to do that in 30 seconds and then also somehow give Salah enough space to get a shot off. What was happening there?
Yeah, I mean, like, it was a collective bunch of errors starting from basically their byline. Maitland-Niles didn't look after the ball well enough. And I'm not sure if we're going to come onto this later, so I'll just cover it now in case we're not. I've seen people blame Maitland-Niles because it was him that gave the ball away. If you give the ball away 100 yards from your own goal, I find it very difficult that you can be to blame for that goal. I'm not protecting Maitland-Niles. I'm not trying to say that we can't criticise this guy, because I've criticised him many times before. But you can't. Literally, it was on their byline. So he was our furthest player forward. So essentially, there is 10 other of our players that could have done something about that. So I think it's very harsh blaming Maitland-Niles for that goal. But it was just a collective. There was a collective mistake. Look, he did make a mistake by giving the ball away. Then Sanchez tried to be clever and nick the ball away instead of just standing in front of it. If he had stood still instead of trying to move his body to the side to knock it away, whoever it was that cleared the ball for them, would, I think it was Milner, would have just kicked it at Sanchez, and it might have bounced in field. It might have gone for a throw on, but it wouldn't have gone straight through to Salah. Jack done really well to show him down the corridor and then didn't follow the run. And that was the first sign of real danger for me. I think Jack eventually tried to, but it was too late by then. He watched Salah's pass, and my angle at the Emirates was perfect for this. I was, from that point, I knew he was in trouble. And I've just seen a picture now, actually, from the spider cam, I think they're called. And we literally had three in a vertical line. So, obviously, if you said our line, if you turned the picture on his side, our defensive line was perfect. But it was obviously not on his side.
Yeah, that's not how you wanted, for sure.
Yeah, so then they've tracked Firmino, and it's a good ball by Firmino, but as I said, no one followed Salah, or no one was alert in time. As I said, Jack belatedly followed him. Then Mustafi sprinted across and then stopped. I don't know why he didn't go and meet the ball, because Hector, there was someone coming up on the outside. I don't know who it was. I think it might have been Robertson. But Hector was there. So at that point, Mustafi's only object, only opponent, is Salah. And he's kind of sprinted towards him, then backed off and just backed off into the area. And he got unlucky with the deflection. And I've seen people blaming Cech, but after the deflection, it gave Cech absolutely no chance. But yeah, I don't understand why Mustafi didn't engage rather than just backing off and letting Salah wander basically to the edge of the area. So there was a collective of mistakes. None of them huge mistakes, but there was four or five mistakes in one move, which is obviously suicidal.
Yeah, I mean, it really was a comedy of errors, as you said. You know, Mustafi gets sucked in to the left first, where we had that vertical line, as you mentioned, and then he backs away. He invites Salah to shoot. I think you're right. Robertson was moving up the field, but I think he was pretty far wide, and it would not have been a good decision on Salah's part to give up the position that he had in terms of attacking our goal.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I only mentioned that in a point that you can't blame Hector for not tucking in, as much as I like to blame Hector for stuff, because I think he's useless. It wasn't his job to tuck in, because if he tucks in and Mustafi tucks in, then you've got Robertson on the overlap. Or, as I said, I think it was Robertson. So I think actually Hector done the right thing by holding his ground, but it was just weird that Mustafi sprinted all the way across and then didn't engage, especially if you're coming across at that speed. And he hadn't been booked, which, I'm a big advocate, and people might call it dirty football, ugly football. I'm a big advocate of taking a booking if you have to. So if Mustafi carries on his sprinting across and doesn't get the ball, he's guaranteed to take Salah out, which would have left them with a free kick at about 35 yards out, not shooting range. Maybe in Coutinho's shooting range, but the wrong side, obviously, for a right footer. So it wouldn't have been as dangerous as it would have been. But to sprint to him and then back off and put yourself on the back foot was just weird.
You've just finished my thought for me, actually. I was just about to say that you cannot let him shoot in that case. The same thing happened almost in the first goal where Koscielny just let Salah run him into the box. You know, it's good to not commit and not be willing to bite the bullet in certain situations, especially when you're against the counter. But in that case, you're absolutely right. You know, just either A, don't let him shoot, or B, foul him. Stop the attack. Stop the flow. But Carl, coming to you, when this goal went in, did you give up? Were you sure that we're not going to get a result at this point?
No, I don't think so. I think it was the start of the first half, and I was like, oh dear, here we go again. But I always have that hope with Arsenal. It was like 40 minutes left. I think that was kind of the catalyst for change for us. I mean, I know Gazidis has used that phrase, and it's not really been used well. But in terms of the game, I thought that was the great turning point for us. I thought that was the trigger, because I'm sure something was said in that dressing room, and something must have come to mind after that second goal went in, thinking we've got to do something here, and we definitely did. And Sanchez scored a great goal straight after that, and then there was like 6 minutes of madness.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, so let's get into it. I mean, what followed might have been some of the best attacking football I might ever seen us play in those, 4 minutes, 35 seconds. I think that's what the tally was. Tony, talk me through the first goal and the response.
To be honest, I think they let us back into the game. The first goal, it was a great ball from Hector. And Gomez fell asleep at the back post, but I don't think it was intricate, nice football. I think, and on Match of the Day last night, they showed that they're 2-0 up away at the Emirates. That we were playing awful, and I disagree with what Carl said earlier. I think it was one of the worst first half I've seen from us. But they're 2-0 up at the Emirates. That we're still always going to be dangerous, and they left 5v5 at the back. That's something I'd expect from us. Like we do stupid stuff like that all the time, and I'm always moaning about it, but. Obviously, they done it, and it was a brilliant ball by Hector. Gomez fell asleep, and Sanchez just nipped in there. But as I said, they gave us that opportunity. They committed people ahead of the ball. They weren't tracking their runners. I think it started from Xhaka found himself on the edge of their box, and he was goal-side of both Chan and Milner, and Coutinho, but Coutinho was well up the pitch. So they let us back in, but that's nothing to take anything away from the ball from Bellerin, which was excellent. Sanchez just nipped in there before the defender. But again, that was, if I was them, I would feel the same way that we did about their second goal. It's just a comedy of errors.
Yeah, I'm sure it was something that Liverpool players were not looking forward to. I mean, you could see their heads go down, and there was some introspection that was required on their end as well. You touched on Xhaka, so I think this segues perfectly into the second goal, and I think there's no one better here to talk about Xhaka than Carl. So we'll get into Xhaka a little bit more later, and soon actually, but just talk me through that second goal and the pureness of that strike, Carl.
That strike was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But I'm going to say something. I'm going to say the keeper definitely should have done better there. I thought, there was a lot of power on that shot, and it went kind of straight for him, and he didn't have a tough enough hand to tip it over the bar or whatever. But still, I think that was a phenomenal strike. I think, when we keep on calling for Xhaka to shoot ever since he scored against Hull, and I think it was Manchester United, the other one. But I thought that was an amazing goal by Xhaka, and he's finally getting him on target again. This is the sort of strikes we need from Xhaka, not the ones that go wayward, and that was a perfect goal to get us back into the game.
Yeah, I agree. I think he had an attempt right after our third goal as well, which was a decent chance, but I think he fluffed his lines. But let's get into Xhaka a little bit and discuss his performance. I've been very far away from Twitter in the last 2 days because it's been so toxic out there that I just don't want to engage, and I've been very quiet. But the Xhaka army, for and against, has been out in full force. Which side of the fence do you sit on, Carl?
At the moment, I'm liking Xhaka because I like him in this three in the midfield formation. When there's two of them, I think with someone like Ramsey, bombing forward, leaving him on his own, I don't think that's a good position for him because, you know, he's got the turning circle of his tractor and he can't really keep up with fast-paced players through the middle. But when it's three in the midfield, I'm really a fan of that. I think that because you've got another guy next to him, and then you've got one up in front of them, like Ozil. I think that's a great formation to have. I think that gives Xhaka a more freer roam type of role. I think he can play that kind of playmaker and then still make those tackles. And he made those tackles against in the Liverpool game, and I was happy to see that. So yeah, in the current formation, I'm a fan of him, but I'm more skeptical if we revert back to the back three. I don't think he performs as well there because he's not given a definite role, or if he is, he's not performing that role.
Tony, there was a lot of frustration in the fans in the stadium. Of course, no one knows that better than you out of the three of us. But I remember paying close attention to Xhaka's performance just because of how he's been under the microscope. Now, I'm looking through my notes here, and the two mistakes that I have written down about Xhaka in the second half, and trust me, I've been writing down, every little detail. The two mistakes is, one, the fluffed shot in the 61st minute, which was after the Ozil goal, which we'll come to in a second. And the second one was in the 85th minute, where this, in my writing, was the first misplaced pass of the second half by Granit Xhaka. And the groans that followed were immense. What is it about Granit Xhaka that bothers the fans at the Emirates and even Arsenal fans anywhere else? There seems to be this extremely high standard that is applied to him for some reason. I mean, he's a great quality player, don't get me wrong. But as soon as one mistake gets made, and this might be true about other Arsenal players as well, but as soon as one mistake gets made, Granit Xhaka gets torn to pieces by the Emirates faithful. What's going on there?
I think there's a few different factors in that. I think one of them, and I touched on it quite well, I spoke about it in quite length the other day, is that in his position, you can't have a good game. If you have a good game, it's not noticeable. As I mean, anyone that listened to our last podcast will know what I'm talking about. So the mistakes are heightened because you think of, take the goal out of it because it was a keeping error and whatnot. It was still a good effort, but it's a keeping error. Second half, he was excellent. First half, he was absolute garbage, which is one of the other factors which led to the groans. It wasn't like, I mean, that might be the first time he gave the ball away in the second half. I haven't obviously watched it back in that much detail, but in the first half, he was nothing short of awful, along with the rest of the players. I'm not singling him out as our worst. I'm just saying he was. So when you've seen him give the ball away, he had an 83% pass completion in the first half. I don't know how many passes he can attempted, so I can't say how many times he gave the ball away, but let's just say it was 10 just for the sake of an argument and to put a number on it. Let's say you've seen him give away the ball 10 times in the first half. When he then gives the ball away in the 85th minute, you don't think of the 40 minutes that he's had that have been good. You think that's the 11th time he's given the ball away. So I think that played a role. And as I said, it's difficult to remember him doing anything good. I thought he defensively was very good. Again, it's something I've touched on recently, in that I think he's really fixed up the defensive side of his game. And his ball distribution's lacking when we've seen the opposite of that for pretty much his whole time at Arsenal. But yeah, I think they're the factors that come into it. And the third one is that we always have a boo boy. I don't know why. I think it's weird. But it's previously been Giroud very heavily. It's been Ramsey. Sanchez has had his little turn. Ozil's definitely had his turn. We, as a fan base, and I don't think it's just in the stadium, I think it's seemingly worldwide from what I see on Twitter, we always have one person where, for some reason, they're not liked. And it goes through stages, and it seems to be his stage.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, as you said, he wasn't great in the first half, but nor was anyone else. I mean, we were trash in the first half, I feel. I agree with Carl. That scoreline against Liverpool at Anfield might not flatter us anymore, but I mean, in terms of incision, in terms of desire, we were the opposite of what we were against Man United in their first half. And, I mean, we were really, really tough to watch. But as someone who was there, can you possibly sum up in words what the atmosphere was like in the Emirates when Mezid scored that goal? We had Martin Tyler on call, and he called it walking into a winter wonderland. Would you agree?
Yeah, so I watched it back when I got home, and I heard Martin Tyler say that. But it was, like, I was going to tweet this after, but I thought it's only going to get abused, and I can't be bothered. But people say the Emirates is quiet, and I would tend to agree with them. But the noise when that third goal went in was unbelievable. I've seen another commentary stream, and they said, oh, the roof has come off the Emirates, and they're not far wrong. Obviously, don't take that literally. The noise was unbelievable. And I was actually interested because one of my mates, we went for food after the game, and he said to me, I wonder what it sounded like on telly because it was so loud in here. And he said, sometimes that doesn't come across. But when I watched it on telly, it came across, the volume was unbelievable. Like if only we could back the team that much every time. But obviously it was I don't want to say a special occasion because we didn't win anything, but to come back from 2-0 down to 3-2 up in 5 minutes, give or take, it's not a normal occurrence. So, but yeah, the atmosphere was mad. It was, the jubilation was unbelievable.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I actually written down in my notes after we scored that goal, or maybe sometime later in the game, there was a moment where Arsenal fans and Liverpool fans were having a go at each other in terms of the volume of their chants. And I thought that was a brilliant moment in terms of the atmosphere at the Emirates. But Carl, I'll come to you and I'll talk to you about Ozil's goal. Once again, we see that finish, which supposedly only Mesut Ozil can do. I haven't seen anyone else do it. But Lacazette, I think this is a good time to talk about Lacazette as well, because we'll come to this later a little bit in terms of man of the match, but he was my standout performer. How well did you do there to find Mesut and for Mesut to finish from that angle and in that manner?
I thought Mesut Ozil's finish again, it defies physics. I think the way he bounces it off the ground to get over the keeper, I think that's absolutely outstanding. I think that's world-class technique, that is. But yeah, Lacazette's contribution to that goal, I think he links up well with our attacking players regardless, but that sort of back heel was great. That fed Mesut Ozil in. He was already making the inside cutting run, and I thought it was a fantastic finish. I think Lacazette had a great game all game, and he didn't get taken off in the 70th minute. Big sigh of relief around the Emirates at that point. But Lacazette always makes good runs in the game, and I thought that opened up the Liverpool defence, which is always shaky. I mean, Klavan and Lovren aren't the best defenders in the world, so Lacazette definitely gave him a few problems that game, and I remember talking about this. I think he was definitely a contender for the man of the match.
Tony, your thoughts on Lacazette?
I know obviously we all spoke about this after the game, and both of you two put him forward, and I know you quite strongly said you thought he was man of the match, and Carl put him forward as we've just heard. I didn't think he was anywhere near it, to be honest. I don't think he was bad. It's not a criticism. I thought in the first half he was anonymous. It's okay making runs. Yes, I know you're doing your job, but to be honest, when the game's going how it's doing, we couldn't pass the ball. So there's no point making runs where the ball would be difficult to get it to you. Our players couldn't pass the ball 5 yards, and I'm including Ozil in that, because usually when we can't play, Ozil still can. But his pass completion in the first half was 63%, and you'll know, look, I don't dwell on stats and percentages, but that is nothing short of awful, and especially when it's Ozil. For any player, that's disgraceful. But for Ozil, that's a joke. So saying, Lacazette made good runs, they're not good runs if your teammates can't find you. And in that first half, we couldn't find each other. So be simple, be safe, keep the ball. I'm not giving Lacazette any credit for them runs. Not that they were bad runs, but you've got to play the situation, not just play regardless. And that's a problem with the club, to be fair. It's not a Lacazette issue. That's Arsenal. We never play situations, we just play. In the second half, he was better. His hold up was good. I don't think he had a bad game. I just don't think he made enough contribution to put him as a candidate for man of the match. Not that there was any standout candidates, but he done unbelievably for the third goal, as you've both touched on. I don't think there's anything I can really add to that. But beyond that, he had no shots on target. I don't really remember any shots off target. I may be wrong. Someone will probably point out one that he did have off target, but again, that's not an achievement. His link up play beyond that third goal, he had a back heel to Sanchez early on, I think at maybe 0-0, it might have been 1-0, that he, similar to for the Ozil goal actually, but he overplayed it, he back heeled it too hard, and Sanchez's touch was it was never going to stick to him because of how hard the ball was played from such a short distance. And I don't think there was any... Like, his link-up was nice and tidy, but there was nothing standout. I don't think Lacazette done anything standout in the game. And again, I'm not saying he had a bad game, but I don't think that puts him... It puts him as a contender for man in the match as strongly as you two think.
I actually don't disagree with you one bit, and I should have explained perhaps more why I chose Lacazette as my man of the match. And actually, I'm a little torn between Lacazette and Granit Xhaka, and those might be some of the more controversial picks out there. But as you touched upon, I think there was no standout performer for us throughout the 90 minutes, particularly in the first half. So what I was basing my judgment off, and that's perhaps the reason I'm a little torn, is the improvement from the first half to the second half. Now, the reason I picked up Lacazette as my choice was that he was so isolated in the first 45, and he was working really hard, trying to press, trying to, as you said, you know, open those channels and hoping for a pass, but which never came. I felt he got so isolated, and he tried so hard in terms of defending from the front, that when he was called upon in the second half, which, again, was not too often, I thought he delivered. I thought he was good when he required to drop deep and, you know, he required to link up play. And he was good when Mesut asked him to thread that ball through. So just based on those factors and the improvement from the first half to the second half is what I based my judgment on. But yeah, I mean, there was no standout performer at all from our team, I would say. I mean, Mesut Ozil probably gets into the spotlight a little bit because he dropped deep in the second half a lot and he was creating a lot in the second half. But based on that first half, I mean, a lot of those players were toothless and scary and scared almost. Carl, who was your man of the match for the game against Liverpool?
As you said, there wasn't really any standout performers, but like, I'd break it down into sections, try and kind of find an answer here, because the first 20 minutes I thought Cech had a really good game, and then obviously he let in that third goal and in the second half, and you know, that kind of tarnished my image of him as being the man of the match candidate. But I think definitely looking back on it now, Niles had a great game. I can't put a word in for any of the other defenders. I thought defensively we had a poor performance, and I think you'd, in my top three, I'd probably say Niles, Xhaka, and Lacazette.
Tony,
it's difficult. Niles is definitely up there. I wouldn't be surprised. Got it. I know Jack got it on Sky, and in the ground, and I think he's gone the opposite. That in the theory with Jack is that he was our probably most consistent player across the game. So you're saying, obviously, you said Lacazette on improvement. I think they've gone the other way with Jack in that he was sort of a 6 or 7 out of 10 in both halves. And he also drove us on. For me, that's not enough to win man of the match. But I also think it's a huge contribution into coming back into the game. I think someone without his drive, forget the ability, because I don't think he showed masses of ability, but someone without his drive probably wouldn't have led to us getting back into the game. So I would go Niles personally, but again, if you're looking at improvement, then I don't see how you can look beyond Ozil, because he was god awful in the first half and very good in the second. But as an overall, I'd prefer someone to be good in both halves than a 1 out of 10 and then a 9 out of 10 in the second half. So for me, I'd go Niles. I thought he was pretty good throughout.
Wonderful. Now I want to talk about Koscielny and Cech a little bit. Carl touched upon Cech a little bit, but we'll come to Cech after we've discussed Laurent Koscielny. Now, what he was doing for that third goal, I have no idea. Leaving position like that and letting Firmino in, essentially, from right outside the box. This brings another question from Sam Spade, who is at Gunnar Mort, M-O-R-T, Sam Spade at Gunnar Mort. Thanks for your question, Sam. He goes on to ask, thoughts on Koscielny's recent performances. How do you see things playing out for him through the rest of the season? Should Arsenal bring in a centre-back in January to possibly replace him? And he goes on to wish all of us a Merry Christmas. Thanks, Sam. Merry Christmas to you as well. We'll start with Tony on this one.
look, I think it's very unlikely we're going to bring in a defender in January, and if we do, it will be as an early replacement for Mertesacker and not Koscielny. I think that's obviously a more pressing issue, because while Koscielny's dropped off, whether it be form is gone or his legs have gone, we don't know. Only that's something you can tell over a long time, but his form is certainly awful at the moment. But as I said, the long-term problem is that Koscielny will still be at the club next year unless something drastic happens, where Mertesacker won't. So if we did sign a centre-back in January, which I don't think we will, it would be as a Mertesacker replacement rather than a Koscielny one. In terms of in what we do with him, I think a back three suits him, especially with his legs going. Look, he's been awful in both systems. Over the last 5 weeks, he's been awful, and we've played both systems. So you can't blame a change in system and not knowing what he's doing, because he was poor against Man United in a five. He was poor against West Ham in a five. He was poor against Southampton in a five. He was nothing against Newcastle in a four. He wasn't good or bad. And he was poor against Liverpool in a four. So you've got both systems there, so you can't blame that. Look, we've been hearing for a long time that his Achilles is pretty much gone and he can't train too hard or he can't play too often, which it beggars belief that he's played them five games. I know he's missed a cup games in between, but he's played them five games in a row, which seems madness, especially with Chambers and Holding both looking good when they have had to come in. I know it's not been in the Premier League, but it seems strange. And I think now over the next few games, we've got a chance to rest him without looking like we're dropping him, even though in reality he should be dropped because he's not been good. But because we've obviously played on Friday, now we've got the 28th and then the 31st. They can rest him and say, look, we've got a lot of games. He's not getting any younger. So it's a rest. And then it doesn't look bad on him. It doesn't look like, oh, your form's been awful, you're dropped. And it does give him a chance to get a rest. So I'd be very surprised if he plays both of them games. I wouldn't be surprised if he misses them both and then comes in for Chelsea. And then he'd get the rest the week after with the Forest game as well, the week after Chelsea. But yeah, for me, and I've said this on our last pod, pre-Newcastle, I said it, that I think he should have been dropped a few weeks ago, because the mistakes he's making is not from, they're not from another player being brilliant. They're all mistakes that I'm not saying he's decided to make, like he's chosen to make them, but they're in his own head. So when he's against Man United, playing a 30-yard ball across your own back line, like, that's the first thing you're taught not to do as a defender. And then just, as you said, rushing out the other day. And again, he didn't rush out to press the ball because he was still 5 yards away from the ball. If you rush out, you have to be in that player's face, not 5 yards away from him. So they're all mistakes that have not been brought on by anyone else. They've been solely Laura Koscielny's fault. So for me, that he has to come out of the team. And look, you never know if his Achilles is playing up and it plays on his mind and it makes you do strange things when you're not 100% fit. But if he's not 100% fit, he shouldn't be playing. And yes, you can blame Wenger's fault for picking him, but if he's playing on his mind that his Achilles is hurting and whatnot and he can't do the job fully, he's an old enough professional now to, he should be putting his hand up and saying, boss, I'm not right. I'm not 100%. And at this time of the year, no one would begrudge that, because especially with the games coming up, and Arsenal, obviously, medical team know his situation. So it is there's blame on all parts, but for me, he shouldn't be playing at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I must confess that we were asked a question a few weeks ago about Laurent Koscielny, and perhaps that question was phrased in a more aggressive manner. But I remember saying that we don't drop players and we don't let go of players for a few bad performances. But I think there's equal blame on the management and on Koscielny here, because I mean, considering his injury and his Achilles problem, he has to be managed better. And when you have someone like Callum Chambers, who's impressed in our second team, and Rob Holding, who's come in and done a job every now and then, I don't see a reason for us to not give Koscielny a rest, because if he's out long term, then that's a bigger problem, and it invites more attack from the opposition. I'll go to Carl and talk to him about Koscielny as well. Carl, what are your thoughts on our skipper?
I think back in the day, if Koscielny got injured or if he was out of the game, we'd be like, we're really going to miss Koscielny in this game because he's been one of our elite defenders for the past few years. But now you think if he's injured for a game, you'd be like, oh, this allows Chambers or Holding to come in and really prove their worth, and we're not really going to miss him that much. And that's kind of a shame, really, because he always has become a good defender. I'm not sure if it's his Achilles that's the major problem here, or it's just his... I don't know. It's kind of he's kind of regressing in terms of kind of his defensive qualities, because I'm seeing, for example, the schoolboy defending and the Pogba involvement in the Manchester United goal the other week with Lingard, where he came up too tight to him in the penalty area. Now that was a stupid decision, and I'm thinking maybe like. I literally do not know what's going on with Koscielny right now, but he definitely deserves to be dropped, and he needs to get out of this rut of bad form. And I don't know how he's going to do that, but I would like to see Chambers come in next to someone like Mustafi in that back four. And again, touching back on that point that I think Tony made earlier about Monreal being in that back four system, let him come out and put Mustafi and Chambers in there and try and culture that relationship instead. Try and give a long-term replacement to the Koscielny-Monreal system.
Yeah, definitely. We'll talk about our upcoming matches here in a bit. But since we're on the subject of our defense, someone I wanted to talk about, who I've again defended over the last few weeks, is Petr Cech. Now, he was very unlucky to concede that first goal, in my opinion. It was a comedy of errors, a slip, a deflection, and Coutinho's first headed goal in the Premier League. Now, this is someone who scores a lot of goals. He's, of course, short, but the fact that this was his first headed goal, I think, is a good summation of how unlucky we were. But the second and the third goal are still bothering me. Now, I've not come out of an Arsenal game thinking that Cech is the problem. I've always thought that our defensive unit is the problem. Against Liverpool, however, I've sort of started reconsidering that. His distribution was awful that day. His positioning on the second goal, I thought, was a little strange. He was almost in the six-yard line when Salah was outside the box. And for the third goal, some people might call it unlucky. I just call it unassured. But I was really bothered by Cech's performances, especially considering that we dropped points. Tony, how serious of a situation is this brewing with Petr Cech?
Look, the club are actively looking at replacing him long term. I've said many times we inquired about Butland in the summer. But again, you don't know if that was in the mind to keep Cech in the team for another year or so. Look, his distribution has always been awful. That's not a one-off thing. His kicking is a disgrace. Keepers spend so much time kicking, even in training. I don't understand how it's so bad. I mean, it is harder at Arsenal because he doesn't have targets. I mean, when he was at Chelsea, he kicked it in the general region of Didier Drogba, and Drogba tended to win things. With us, he has no real targets, but that's no excuse for kicking the ball 20 yards away from your target. His kicking's always been bad. And I'm not sure what the keeper's doing training, because the last keeper we had that could kick a ball was Fabianski. Let's be honest, Ospina can't kick a ball. Szczesny's kicking was a joke. It was ambitious, but it was a joke. Fabianski could kick a ball. And, it's just we don't seem to... Almunia can never kick a ball. I don't know what they do. I don't know if they spend the whole time just focusing on shot-stopping or coming for crossing. I don't know what they do, but someone needs to kick that. I mean, look, Martinez can kick a ball, but he's not a good enough keeper, and obviously he's out on loan now, so there's no point speaking about him. With the second goal... I actually make you wrong in blaming his positioning. The further out from your goal you are, obviously the less space the player has to aim for. So unless it goes over him, which it didn't. Look, if he gets chipped there, then you've got half an argument. But Salah's, 18 yards out, so there's no way that the ball's going to get up and over him in that range. So I don't think there was anything wrong with his positioning. Had the ball not been deflected, he would have saved it. That deflection may have only made half a yard to a yard's difference, but it was a vital yard. And you've got to think that instead of that ball now coming from 18 yards, where Salah shot from, it's now 16 yards. Because when a ball deflects, you may as well take it as a completely different shot, like that's come from the range of where it's hit the defender, which is why deflections are so hard to deal with. Because you set yourself going one way or in one direction for a shot, and then it changes course, but it also changes course a lot closer to you. So you take it as a 16-yard shot, and he was a bit unsighted because Mustafi was square in front of him. So I don't blame him at all for the second goal. Look, I'm not Czech's biggest fan, but I'm much just the opinion that you would have been before the game, in that, is it an issue? Yes. Is it a pressing issue? Is it the issue we need to get sorted soonest? Absolutely not, in my mind. Having said that, the third goal is unforgivable. He didn't get fingertips to it. He got a full hand. And arguably, had he wanted to, it was a choice. In my opinion, it was a choice to only go with one hand. He could have got two hands to it. He was, again, like you said, I mean, you think he was too far out of the goal for the first. He was further out for the second from a shot from probably the same range. Again, I don't see that as an issue. But when you are that far out of the goal, you can't push a ball up in the air because there's a lot of space. If you're on a goal line or 1 yard from the goal, you can push it up in the air because you know it's not going to drop down into the goal in time and it'll go out for a corner. It might land on the roof of the net, but that's safe. So you can't be pushing it up in the air. You've got to push it wide or even back out. Because of the angle of the shot, back out automatically takes it wide. It's not like he would have been pushing it back into the middle of the area. So then even once he chose to do that option of pushing it up in the air, how weak are his hands to let it go through like that? Again, I think there was, again, so many errors, like just from him, well, obviously Koscielny initially, but he made about 3 or 4 errors in one save. And basic errors for someone of his quality, calibre and class in what he's been or what he is as a keeper in the past. The third goal for me was really unforgivable, but again, I don't think it is a pressing issue, but it's not the one issue. If I was to list our issues and what we need to sort out, he may be in the top three, maybe, but he definitely wouldn't be one or two.
Yeah, I think I stand corrected. Maybe I was a little too quick to blame Czech there, and I was being a little harsh. But Carl, what are your thoughts on Czech? And I know you've been an advocate of replacing him, but in the short term, I mean, in the long term, we don't know what our club is going to do. But in the short term, do you think it's advisable to maybe give Ospina a go in the Premier League?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he's been particularly good in the Premier League. I think I don't know if it's because I'm not a fan of his height, and I know he's an acrobatic keeper, and he makes these good saves, and he acts like he gets injured every game. But regardless, I don't think he's Premier League standard for us in terms of the first team. I think definitely we keep with Czech for now. I mean, it's kind of like our only option at the moment, unless if Czech starts conceding like 4 goals a game. Then maybe we start thinking of putting Ospina in there. We don't want to be forced down that route that we start, you know, have to resort to that after, you know, conceding 4 goals a game, as I've said, which is probably unrealistic. But still, I think he's still a good enough keeper, and there are some major flaws, but he can put in a good shift as well. I think as I said, in those first 20 minutes, I think he was one of our best players. He's kept us in the game. I think there was a few shots there that he saved that could have gone in, but I don't know, throughout the game he got worse and worse, and as Tony said about his distribution, that's another thing, that's another pet peeve of mine when it comes to Czech. And definitely in the long run we need someone like him, but just someone better. I mean, like, in terms of reactions, in terms of kicking is kind of a must in terms of an Arsenal goalkeeper, because as Tony said again about Fabianski being our last good kicker of the ball, I think if we get a keeper that has a really good, like, kind of mixed, like a hybrid of good reactions and kicking, I think we'll be on to a winner.
Ederson.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's added such a big dynamic to that Man City squad, which is down to his kicking, I would argue. He's a great shot stopper. I think he's shown his goalkeeping abilities too, but having that backup and behind you as a defender, I feel when you're comfortable playing the ball and then creating space to receive the ball back from your goalkeeper, and you're short in his ability, I think that always helps. But those goalkeepers are very, very few in the world out there. But yeah, I mean, we'll see how Cech does. I think you're right. I think Cech will continue to feature in the Premier League. I think there's a lot of experience there that overshadows Ospina's ability or lack thereof. But someone who I wanted to talk about a little bit, and I'll go back to Tony for this, is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. Now, I was curious to see what the Emirates was going to do. I thought before the game, I thought it was going to be based on how the game was pegged. And Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain comes on, what, sometime, I think, in the 75th or 76th minute. And a mixed reaction. Were you surprised, or were you expecting it to be one way or the other?
I'd say it was about 70% booze, 30% clapping. And the clapping wasn't like a returning hero. It was more like a respect thing. Look, I was booing, and you can take, I like Alex, and everyone knows I like Alex, but I've always said that I can't forgive lack of effort. I can forgive someone playing bad. If it had just played away at Liverpool and been awful, I can forgive that. Everyone has bad days. I have bad days at my job. I'm sure you have bad days at your job. Footballers have bad days at their job. I've seen Cristiano Ronaldo be bad. I've seen Lionel Messi be bad. It's not choice. It happens. A lack of effort is a choice, which is, for me, was unforgivable. Some people around me were clapping, and when people were saying, like, it wasn't an argument. When people were saying, why are you clapping? They went, well, we got a load of money for an average player. And I thought, well, that's not really anything to do with him. He didn't say, I'm not leaving unless Arsenal get 35, 40 million pounds. I think he held us to ransom. Not held us to ransom. He lied to the club. Like, again, whether people know this or not, he lied to the club for a good year, saying, yeah, I'm going to sign. My agent's just messing about. I mean, I know, and I was tweeting it at the time, and I think it's pretty much come out now that we all knew full well he wasn't going to sign. So I don't really understand the people clapping. Had it not been for that game at Anfield, I would have been one of the ones clapping. Because the only thing for me that he'd done was unforgivable. Again, you can forget bad performances. It's not someone's fault if they're bad. But had it not been for that game away at Anfield, then I would have been clapping as well, to be honest. It wouldn't have been a rapturous round of applause, but it would have been a respectful sort of welcome back, so to speak. I was a bit surprised at the claps. But then I don't know if it's different for me, and I don't want to be one of them people that says, oh, you weren't there. But I don't know if it's different for me because I was at Anfield that day. I don't know if that makes things slightly different. Because for me, sitting in that crowd when I've travelled however many miles and I've paid however much for petrol, hotel, my match ticket, it was unforgivable.
Mm-hmm. Carl, thoughts? If Chamberlain had come on and scored, would you have expected him to celebrate?
No, but I would have expected. I know when we were talking about the Emirates roof blowing off, I think it'd be blowing off in terms of the booze. I think it'd be absolutely atrocious the amount of booze that Oxlade-Chamberlain would have got. I think it's always harder for us to kind of accept a player back and kind of applaud them when they've gone to a direct rival. So, for example, when Fabregas came back to the Emirates as part of Chelsea, the first reaction that we had was boo. But then I think with all these players, gradually we go to cheering towards the end. I mean, when he started, clapping the fans at the end of the game, everyone started clapping him. So I was like, OK, that's all right. But I know I said it was his substitution was nearer the 84th minute, I think. And I remember saying at the start of the game, I think, oh, it'd be banter by the Liverpool coaching staff. They bring him on the 85th minute. I wasn't far wrong. I thought that they were going to do that just to get the reaction. But I don't know. I think that some of it is deserved, of course, because of that Liverpool performance. But obviously, there's got to be kind of an element of respect there for what he's done for the club. He might not have done much, but he's still a player that's played over 100 games for us all the same.
Fair enough. I think that's all I have on my notes for the Liverpool game. Is there something more you guys want to talk about, or should we move ahead with some other questions we've received?
I just wanted to add, and it may be a bit of a dig at Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, that he left to play in centre midfield, and all week leading up to the game, we've had Liverpool fans telling us, mainly on Twitter, because I don't know too many Liverpool fans, saying that he's been brilliant, he's turned the corner, Klopp's managed to get a player out of him because he had one good game at Bournemouth. and it's probably his first good game for them. And he got man of match. And even I was watching the Bournemouth game on Sky, and Sky was saying, oh, this is it. He's really turned now. Like, he never had good games for Arsenal, which is wrong, because he did. But he left Arsenal to go and play at centre midfield in Liverpool. He was essentially their sixth choice centre midfielder yesterday. Because they started with Friday. They started with a three. Henderson went off, Milner come on, so there's four. Then Coutinho came off and Wijnaldum came on, so there's five. So by the time Oxlade-Chamberlain came on, he is their sixth choice centre midfielder. Bear in mind they're adding Naby Keita in the summer, but they may lose Emre Can. He's not getting any further forward in the line. I don't know, it doesn't baffle me, but I think it's quite ironic, really, that he would probably been fourth or fifth choice at Arsenal, and he's sixth choice there. The grass isn't always greener, as they say.
I think that's a very valid point. I can't remember who it was, and I apologize for not accrediting them with this, but someone was talking about why Chamber made the switch, and they were reiterating your point that, you know, he's not made it up the pecking order in order to feature midfield. And I think someone made a point that when Oxlade-Chamberlain probably had a conversation with Klopp and, you know, people at Liverpool, he probably realized that, or he probably thought, maybe not realized, that he can learn something again under this coach, under Klopp as a manager. Now, everyone says that, you know, Arsene Wenger is pretty hands-off, and he allows the freedom, you know, he allows players to express their own qualities. So maybe the conversation with Klopp, and again, this is just speculation, maybe the conversation with Klopp was that, okay, you know, in the next few years or whatever months, we build you to play in center midfield. Until then, you operate as a squad player. I don't want to get into this too much, but I just feel that he went there to learn the trade of midfield. I think he was never happy out wide at Arsenal. He was tried in midfield, and he never grew in the mold. I think there was no focus training on that as being a true option either from Wenger's side. And I think he saw someone in Klopp who, from the outside, seems like a very friendly and very hands-on guy. And maybe the conversation went that way. Do you think I'm just being a little too positive and being too fond of the Ox? Because I am biased towards the Ox. I've always been a fan. So maybe I'm just being too optimistic for him.
I mean, look, Klopp's obviously told him what he wants to hear, because he turned down Chelsea as well, because Chelsea wanted him to play at wing-back the same as we did. I don't know. I mean, I disagree to an extent with what you're saying, and it's just that he said, I wanted to play here, and two managers, and you can't look, one thing, you may accuse Wenger of being hands-off, we don't really know, but it is a perception that he's hands-off. Conte, you definitely can't accuse of being hands-off. We know he's not. You can see that on the touchline. I would say he's probably more exuberant than Klopp. He's just not as entertaining with it, so it doesn't get the same headlines or the same media time. But I literally just think Klopp's told him what he wants to hear. He said, I want to play centre midfield. And Klopp said, OK. And the other two, being Wenger and Conte, have said no. I'm trying to pull it into a lifelike situation that I would be in, like in a shop where one shopkeeper says I can have it for the price something I want for the price I want, and two other people tell me I can't. I don't care about the quality of their sales skills. They're giving me what I want, whereas the other two may be far superior salesmen. This is a terrible analogy, by the way. But they might be far superior salesmen, but they're not giving me what I want. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see it. I don't see the hands off and whatnot being an issue, because you've got Wenger, who's known as quite passive, Conte, who's known as very hands on, and Klopp may be on par with Conte, maybe, for, in my opinion, just below in terms of hands onness. So you can't blame either of them reasons when the two options were the opposite ends of the spectrum, and he's gone for the one that I would say is in the middle.
Yeah. Carl, thoughts on the Ox, or any other closing thoughts on Liverpool versus Arsenal? Arsenal versus Liverpool, my mistake.
I just thought it was a very, very entertaining game. Take away the first half, I think the second half was an amazing spectacle. I think Liverpool versus Arsenal always going to bring up goals, and I know in the preview podcast, I think it was me and Tez predicted it to be 3-2, and we weren't far wrong, and I think that should have been the final result, apart from a bad performance in terms of trying to save the ball by Cech. I think we should have won that game and closed it out, but fair play to Liverpool. I think they played well. I think we're kind of similar in the way that we both have potent attacking forces and just kind of lackluster defensive performances at the moment. But, hopefully we can improve and they can't, so we can go above them in the Premier League.
Couldn't have summed it up myself any better. Moving on, we have a few questions that that didn't feature throughout our earlier discussion, so I'll just quickly get those to you guys. We'll start with Tony on this one, and this question is from Zain Ali. He asks, okay, here it goes. Have you started to play to Ozil's strengths? I think Wenger has realized that he should build the team around him if he stays. Tony?
It's difficult to say. Look, Ozil's obviously been very good in recent weeks, but have we changed that much? We've put him back at 10, but I'd argue in the 3-5-2 that he was pretty much a 10. Look, that bit we have changed and it does suit him more, but I don't think it's that drastic of a change, because I know on the starting positions when we played a 5 at the back, it showed Ozil was being wide right and Sanchez being wide left, but he was never wide. He was never on the touchline. He would sort of drift about. But being in an actual 10 does suit him more. Beyond that, are we doing anything different than we did, when was it, January, February, March, when we played a 4-2-3-1? For me, no. We've got a more mobile striker ahead of him. But then I don't think they've really shown that link up in terms of Lacazette running away from the ball since Ozil's been playing 10. So it's only been 2 games. I mean, it's not criticism, but that does suit him more. But we've not seen evidence of that yet. But then I'd also argue that on the other side, we've taken away, because every other time he played 4-2-3-1, we had Walker on the right, who, as we mentioned earlier, runs in behind, whereas we've been playing Iwobi there, who comes to feet, which I would argue doesn't suit Ozil. And he's never going to get assists for Iwobi, really, because Iwobi's not in the positions to score the goals. So I'd argue in one hand that the 4-2-3-1 suits him more, and that we've added to a system that he would enjoy by putting Lacazette ahead of him. But then we've also taken away in certain aspects as well.
Carl, thoughts on Mesut Ozil and our future being built around him?
I think that's something we should have done from the start when we first bought him, but obviously we didn't do that. But I think in this new 4-3-3 formation, I think he's definitely performing better. I mean, regardless if he was in at 3 at the back or the four at the back, I think he has that access or ability to go, free roam in terms of creating chances. And the 4-3-3 to put him, I wouldn't say in more of a regimented structure with two men behind him, but and him being cemented as the number 10. But I think it plays to his strengths a lot better. I know that was the initial question. And I agree that this formation does play to his strengths. So you've got Lacazette playing in front, and you've got Sanchez down the left, and then got other players like Iwobi down the right, maybe, or playing in the middle. But that's the only problem I'd say with this new system, that Iwobi's in there and he definitely shouldn't be in there. Definitely shouldn't be in there.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a stab at this as well, Zain, and I'm gonna say that we have started to play to his strengths. I mean, we ever since Mesut Ozil has come to our club, we've tried to get the most out of him. I think where we've lacked is sort of countering where Mesut Ozil may not be the strongest player. And to be fair to Mesut Ozil, he may not need to perform in that situation. What I'm trying to get at is that if he is giving you that X factor and that extra going forward, he takes away a little bit in defense. And that's where we've failed to sort of build around Mesut Ozil, if you will. I think it's pretty moronic, if you ask me. I think we've hit and miss a few times. Coquelin came back from loan, for example, and he put in a shift, and for a moment there, it felt like he might be a solution, definitely short term, if not long term. But I think we've not been able to to plug those holes that have been opened up by, you know, players like Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez, who bring so much when going forward, but may not necessarily bring that while we've struggled defensively. But it is something to keep an eye out on, and as the contract situation unfolds, we'll see whether Mesut Ozil is a part of our future. Just on that, considering we're talking contracts, there's a question on Alexis Sanchez, and Tony, I'll go to you on this. This is from Come On You Gunners at Elton Chu. That's ELTONTCHOO. Go give him a follow. ELTONTCHOO. There was reports recently about how Alexis Sanchez had a gentleman's agreement. This is how the article describes it, with Arsenal. The contract terms had been agreed. The two parties had shaken hands, and apparently after our thumping over two legs against Bayern Munich, that 10-2, things went downhill, and it's suspected that Alexis Sanchez sort of just stopped dealing with the contract team at Arsenal. Do we know what this is about and how true this might be?
It's completely untrue. I don't really want to spend too much time on it because it's nonsense. One report said that the link that Elton whatever sent us was from Bleacher Report, which was taken from a journalist in the Times, not a well-known one. That if this was one... These stories like that, they go to the most well-known journos. And also, had that been the case, Arsenal would have been leaking it to high heaven to show that he's the bad guy and not the club. In all due respect to Arsenal, the club, that they've not really leaked anything negative about him. The story is just nonsense. It's as simple as that. And also, I think further on in the story, it says, oh, at that point, he decided to join City. They went out to Monaco in the Champions League at the same stage, and Monaco ended up doing very well, but it was a Monaco team that no one really rated. No one expected them to do anything. You remember at that time, Lamar was unknown, Mbappe was unknown, Falcao was finished, so to speak. They had centre backs Glick, who no one, like Polish average 5 million centre back. No one had ever rated Mende. No one had ever rated Sidibe. Bakayoko was unknown. Fabinho was, to some extent, unknown. I'm not saying that Monaco team was bad, but City went into that tie expected to win and win comfortably, and they went out. So it's not like we went out to Bayern and he thought, I'm going to join City, and then City also had a terrible result. So then if that was his thinking, he would have also gone, oh, actually, they're a bit shit as well. I'll go to Juventus, for example, or Bayern Munich, or whoever. So, I mean, look, the story is just complete nonsense. As I've always said, you mention anything to do with Arsenal, you get clicks, and the more controversial, the more clicks.
And there you go. I think that answers your question, Elton Chu. I like that. I like Twitter handle. Speaking of nonsense, we hear from our friends, Gooners in the USA, which for all our listeners and people who have not heard them yet, go give them a go. Those guys are very nonsensical. They're podcast is full of tomfoolery and shenanigans, and it's peppered and garnished with a lot of Arsenal. So these guys are amazing. Mike and Andy are always talking with all of us, and they have some really interesting comments on how we play football. For Mike, if you're listening to this, I have a question for you. Should we shoot more? And I'll wait for your answer. But he asked a question, and Tony, I'll stick with you since you're the boxing expert on this podcast. For you, who's your favorite boxer, Michael Spinks or Julie Niles?
Yeah, so I didn't know her first name, but Julie Niles is Maitland Niles' mum. And for anyone that don't know and think this is a bit of a weird random question, because obviously Spinks was a world champion and Niles' mum is Niles' mum, she was banned from the Ipswich training ground when he was on loan there for going and telling the manager where he should be playing. And she was basically trying to pick the team. So she was banned. I think there's been quite a few problems with her down the years. I think she was banned from Arsenal's training ground at one point as well, but don't quote me on that. So I don't know if she carries a brick in her handbag or something, but she's definitely got people running scared of her. But I wouldn't fancy her over 12 rounds. So Yeah, if there's a world title on the line, I'll be going with Mr. Spinks. But if she's listening, then I'm sure she's a lovely lady, and don't beat me up, please.
If she is listening, then Miss Niles, you can find Tony at clockhand_talk. Once again, that's clockhand_talk. All right, self-plug over. Carl, question from MAA Gaming. Now, we touched upon this a little bit, but he takes it to the next level. He goes on to say that, I don't think this will happen, but do you think if we should put our reserve team in the Premier League games and play our first team in cup games and in the Europa League? He ends his question there, so I'm not sure whether he's saying that, whether he's asking that out of frustration or whether he's trying to shift focus to the Europa League. I'm guessing the latter, but I'll let you have a go at it.
No, I wouldn't do that, because first and foremost, the Premier League is our kind of it's our goal. I mean, it's our domestic league. It's like saying that Juve should just play all their reserve players in the Serie A and just focus on Champions League. They wouldn't do that. Even though they might go far in that competition, like we'll go far in the Europa League, they wouldn't do that just for the sake of getting a European Cup. I think, yeah, your first and foremost goal is to get your best enough your best standing in your own domestic league, let alone one that's... that's kind of over Europe. And I think that's a ludicrous idea. I think if you're trying to point to the idea of the fact that some certain players need dropping and some people from the youth team or the second team should be brought up, then okay. But that's a bridge too far, in my opinion. That's been kind of melodramatic.
Yeah, I agree. Till the time we don't come against tough opposition in the Europa League, particularly, I think we should continue playing the youngsters and trying to snatch results that way. I think we're done in terms of questions. We have a few other things to discuss. Some news that's been making the headlines and some games to look forward to. Before we get into that, I just wanted to ask you guys a question. We didn't get this on Twitter, but I just had to ask you guys, considering Thomas Rosicky just retired from football. Carl, your favorite Thomas Rosicky, memory or memories?
I'm going to say the one that most people are going to say, and that's a great goal against Tottenham. what a goal that was. That was absolutely amazing. I love Thomas Rosicky. He loved the club, even though he wasn't played all the time and he was kind of hampered down by injuries. I always loved the player. He was like, even in his kind of his mid-30s going into like 34, 35 at Arsenal, he still played like he was in his mid-20s. That's what I always kind of... That's what always mystified me, in a sense, around Rosicky. And I thought he was an amazing player and a fantastic servant to the club. I'll miss him. And thanks for the memories, Thomas.
Well said. Tony?
There's so many. He was just a joy to watch. Obviously, he had these injury issues, but just the way he played the game was lovely to watch. And I think it was him that the original quote was, is if you love football, you love Rosicky. And I know Wenger said that about quite a few players now, but as far as I'm aware, he originally said it about Rosicky. The goal against Tottenham was very good, but it was unbelievable. But for me, it's one of them, you hit it and sometimes it'll go in, and the majority of the time it'll hit someone in row Z. I'm not taking away from the goal, but I've got three that I struggled to choose between. The 3-2, the goal that made it 3-2 against Tottenham in our first 5-2 win against them. It was at a time when he wasn't as adored by the fans. And I think that was the game that probably turned it, because not only did he score, his drive in the whole game just sort of showed how much he loved the club and especially against Tottenham wanted to win. For me, one of my favourite goals... Arsenal goals in my lifetime, and I think it's, and I probably like it because it is so underrated. He scored a goal against Sunderland, and I think we won 4-1. I can't remember the exact score, and it was a lot like Wilshere's goal against Norwich, with tight intricate passing, they end up dinking it over the keeper. And for me, it's just one of the most underrated goals in my opinion, it's just a very underrated goal.
That Wilshere goal sort of overshadows it, but it's almost symmetrical, isn't it?
Yeah, for me, there's an argument that it's better. The only thing is that he had a bit more time, whereas it wasn't all one touch. So obviously it's a bit more calculated, but I would say there's arguments with some parts of that Wilshere goal. Was it deliberate? A couple of Giroud's flicks, were they deliberate? Whereas the Riziki one, for me, everything was meant. Every little pass was meant, and definitely meant. I'm not saying it wasn't with the Jack ones, but there is doubt. Whereas that, you knew exactly what they were doing. But for me, my favourite moment came off the pitch. And I think he'd already left Arsenal at the time when they said to him, what do you love about London? And he said, Arsenal. And I said, what's the worst thing about London? Tottenham. For me, that's players don't say that. Like, and especially foreign players. Again, I don't want to get into the debate of foreign fans, but they tend to not have that hate for Tottenham inside them because they didn't grow up hating Tottenham. Thomas Rizicki didn't grow up hating Tottenham. He probably didn't know who they were. So to sort of learn that and take that on board and be fully on board with it, even after you stop playing for the club, for me, shows a lot and is worth a lot.
I agree completely. I think Podolski was one of those players in recent memory too, who, as you said, you know, probably didn't know of Tottenham, maybe definitely didn't know of Tottenham, and they, for one reason or the other, they seem to have gotten that pretty early on in their Arsenal careers, and that's what we love. That's what we love to see. So yeah, from everyone here at the Clock End Talk, thank you, Little Mozart. Thank you, Thomas Rosicki, for giving us the memories you've given us, because you've been a fantastic servant for, you know, for our club, and that's all we ask. Moving on to another person who has sort of been an Arsenal stalwart in recent memory, was Mikel Arteta. Now, Mikel Arteta is already dividing opinion, you know, I mean, everyone knows he came to Arsenal quite late in his career, and he did a job for us. But now there's been a lot of rumors about how he might be up for, Wenger's job, and as some are even speculating as soon as this summer. Am I too naive in thinking this is just way too over the top and there's absolutely no chance of this happening, Tony?
No, I'd agree with you. I don't think Wenger's going to go this summer anyway, so any name they put forward, I think, is pretty much nonsense at this stage. But Arteta, we don't know how good he's doing it. Even at Man City, you can say he's coming to a Man City team that are clearly unbelievable, but we don't know what he's doing. He may be doing absolutely nothing. I doubt it, but it's possible. He was always earmarked while he was at the club as a future manager, not about just in general, he was going to be a manager. So there's that sort of precedent there. But to go into Arsenal as your first job, I don't think it will ever happen. But it's difficult to break into football nowadays because even say, just again, it's not going to happen, but say Swansea are looking for a manager. Do they take the risk of taking an Arteta as a first job? And then even if they do, if he doesn't do poorly there, then he's never going to get that step up to an Arsenal and Man City or whoever. So it's difficult, but I can't see a club that big of Arsenal in modern day football taking a chance like that. And don't get me wrong, it is a chance. And also, I'm led to believe that there's some, not bad blood, but I can't think of a lesser way of putting it, between Arsenal and Arteta, in a sense that we sort of built him up. Whether we officially done it or not, he had a coaching role for his last bit of time at the club while he wasn't playing. And then as soon as he decided to pack up, he swanned off to Man City. That may be because Arsenal didn't offer him anything, but it still leaves a bit of taste in the mouth that you've sort of given him the first step on the ladder, be it unofficially. And then as soon as he's ready to start climbing, he does it elsewhere.
Carl, how ironic is it that 21 years on, we are considering someone who is new to the managerial world and using that against him in an argument when we brought in a manager, as I said, 21 years ago, who had zero experience, albeit in a league which was less competitive, but at the same time, you had the strong players back then who were still strong. You had the Man United, team running riot, and maybe that's about it, actually. Newcastle, to an extent, you could argue. But how ironic is it that we are actually debating bringing in a manager with fresh expertise when that's exactly what we did earlier?
I think it's quite ironic, but I also think that I don't want to simply say that times have changed, but they have. I mean, when Wenger came in, he kind of caused a revolution in English football. I know only on like the microcosmic scale, you've got the idea of like him changing up the nutrition and the fitness regimes and stuff like that. But in terms of the long term, the way he kind of brought a new style of from around the continent in terms of play style, the way he brought that to Arsenal, I don't think that can be matched again. So I don't think the best idea at all is to bring someone in that's inexperienced again. I don't think that lightning strikes twice in that sense. I think if and when we replace Wenger, we've got to get someone who's been in the managerial business for quite a long time, because we're going to need someone. It's going to be the same as Manchester United after Ferguson. There's obviously going to be a big hole left by Wenger when he eventually leaves. So you've got to get someone that's going to kind of take the brunt of all like the ramifications that are caused after Wenger's departure, I guess. So getting someone that's inexperienced coming in, I think that's the worst idea we could do, especially in terms of Mikel Arteta.
That's a very fair argument, and I have nothing to add to that. I think you guys did said exactly what I would have said. So we can move on and switch lanes now and look forward to our next two games, which are the only two remaining games in before we get into the new year. So we have Crystal Palace away, and we then travel to the Hawthorns to play West Brom. Now, before we get into lineups and what sort of rotation we expect, there was news today that Giroud has picked up a hamstring tear and that he might be out for about 6 weeks. So that's quite a blow, if you ask me. Plus, Nacho was subbed off at halftime against Liverpool, so I haven't seen any updates about that. But based on at least these two recent developments, I mean, we knew Giroud was going to be out anyway, but based on at least what we know about Nacho, Tony, what sort of lineups do you expect for these two games?
The difficulty with obviously Nacho being out, I don't know if they've got a time on it. Giroud, it leaves us with a lack of rotation up front. It leaves us with only Welbeck and Lacazette that can play up top. I would expect Welbeck has to play one of the two against West Brom and Palace, because especially as we've said before, Lacazette's used to a winter break. So I think there'll be quite a lot of rotation between the two games, but I don't expect to see a whole different team in one game. I don't think there'll be many players that play in both, or play four games in both. So you may get, in an ideal world, we'd have Palace wrapped up after 60 minutes. I don't think we will. I think it'll be a very hard game, actually. But in an ideal world, we'd have it wrapped up after 60 minutes, and we'd have made some changes anyway. As I said, I expect Kolasinac to come back in. I'd imagine Debuchy will play in one of the two games. As I said, I'd imagine Chambers will play. It's going to be an interesting situation with Jack Wilshere, because he's arguably been, he's been one of our better players in all of the games he's played recently. Mm-hmm. But do you put the trust? Look, he looks fit, he looks strong, but do you put the trust in him to play two games in 3 days, essentially? I personally wouldn't, but then the alternative is playing Coquelin or Elneny, which on its own isn't disastrous, but when it's alongside a Xhaka or alongside each other, it really isn't ideal. So it's a tough one. This period's always tough, and it is a real test. And we can only see what comes of it. But I think we are a bit short in central midfield, in terms of we're playing two teams that aren't going to attack us particularly. So we don't need two defensive midfielders, but I fear we're going to have to play two defensive midfielders in at least one of the games due to not wanting to overplay Jack. And unless Wenger does want to unless Wenger feels Jack's capable of playing both. And look, we've seen nothing this year that says he isn't, but obviously we're always overcautious with Jack due to history, essentially.
Yeah. I think it's not a question of whether he can play 90 minutes, and I know that's not what you meant, but I think it's a question of whether we want to play him in those two back-to-back games, considering Ramsey's missing too, and then we have very little attacking coming from our midfield. Carl, thoughts on the lineups and what sort of rotation to expect over the next two games?
I think for the first game, we'll probably go with our normal lineup, but with a couple of changes. I think the second game will kind of be a modified cup team. There'll be less of the youth, but there'll be more first team experience. I think it'll be like the best of both, because with all due respect to these two sides, they're not the sort of teams that you'd consider big to be featured in big games. I think we can afford to use types of players like Holding, Chambers, Coquelin, who I thought that it might be a kind of a controversial opinion. I think he's been quite good recently. I think he's had a few good games for us, and I think it's quite funny that he started bringing out all these skills in his locker. But regardless, I think Coquelin's going to feature. Elneny definitely will. I was thinking, apart from Welbeck and Lacazette, I'm thinking Wenger might revert back to Alexis up front again if push comes to shove, but and try and feature Walcott back into the team. And I know Iwobi, even though how much we kind of dislike him at the moment, based on his form, he definitely will feature. So it's going to be like a best of both, I guess, for both games. We're not going to do a really strong team and a really weak team the next game. I think it's going to be a mixture. But I think I don't think it'll be too hard a task to get 6 points out of those two games over the Christmas period.
Yeah, well, I sort of disagree with that. I think Crystal Palace has been on a good run of form. I think they've been unbeaten in the last 7 or 8 games. I think ever since Roy Hodgson took over, they've been flying. But West Brom, on the other hand, I think is going to be an easier proposition. And I would feel that we play a stronger 11 against Palace and then sort of rotate for West Brom based on the quality of the opposition and B, having an eye on the Chelsea game. But yeah, 6 points would be more than welcome. I think over the last few games, we've dropped points unnecessarily, and no disrespect to these teams, but when we are playing teams who are much lower than us in the table, then we ought to be performing well enough to easily walk away with the points, but that doesn't seem to be the case. I think that wraps us up for today, unless you guys have any other comments or any other things to point out. I think that's about it.
No, for me.
So just before we head out, it is Christmas time. Everyone's at home with family and where not, and celebrating. So I thought I'll ask you guys what you guys are doing for Christmas, and I invite our listeners to share what they did for Christmas and how they celebrated. So Carl, what are you doing for Christmas, and where are you at?
I'm at my mother's house. I'm probably going to get a bit drunk.
Wonderful. Short and crisp. Tony?
Yeah, so I'm visiting grandparents, but we've got pretty much the whole family here at some point over the weekend. Some of you eagerly listeners may have just heard my mum butting in to offer me a cup of tea. I quickly muted my microphone, so you may not have heard that, but that's the rock and roll lifestyle that I lead.
Absolutely fantastic. I'm going to be doing a little bit of the same. I'm going to be, I'm not going to be spending time with family, but I'm going to have a lot of tea during this time. It's getting cold here, and I'm working during this Christmas time, but that gives me time to sit down with you guys and talk Arsenal every now and then, so I'm not complaining. To all our listeners out there, have a Merry Christmas. Enjoy your winter vacations wherever you are, or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, enjoy the heat and don't give a shit about how great it is out there and how terrible it is for us. Keep it real, keep it Arsenal, and we guys will see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.